Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to the Indie Football Podcast. I'm your host, Jack Pitbrook, and I'm joined today by Chief Sports Writer Jonathan Liu.
Hello.
Luke Brown.
Hello.
And Rory Campbell, our special guest today. He's the owner of CNN Sporting Risk, has a background in football analytics and sports betting, and offers consultancy and predictive modelling to various sectors of sports betting. So today we're going to bring in some of his analytical data insights into our football chat. The weekend started with Tottenham Hotspur beating Swansea City in the FA Cup quarterfinal. Jonathan, you were there. What did you make of it?
I thought Tottenham made it a lot easier for themselves than they could have done. I think Swansea certainly weren't writing it off, given their relegation troubles. They hadn't reached a FA Cup quarterfinal since 64, and it was a really disappointing afternoon for them. Spurs were great. Eriksen was brilliant, and a different kind of Eriksen performance to the one we normally see from him, because without Kane, without Dele Alli, they needed Eriksen to be not just their heartbeat, but also their kind of their energy as well. And it was a real sort of Denmark against Ireland performance from him, where he kind of grabbed the game. So yeah, Spurs into the semi-finals, and then they'll play United, I think, in the semi-final. And yeah, pretty decent performance from them.
It's a topic that's come up a lot, but how much do you think Tottenham need to win a trophy this season? Or do you share the kind of Pochettino view that the trophies are less relevant than the actual performance?
Well, it's become kind of a bit of a running joke amongst Spurs fans, like, yeah, but have they won a trophy, as in just a kind of a stick to beat them with? I mean, my view on this, and it's not quite aligned with Pochettino, who basically sees a trophy as like a just part of the process. And he was saying this again after the game, that the process is the new stadium, the process is this one of continual improvement, and the trophies are kind of a less important, basically they're just the byproduct. If they do the process right, the trophies will follow, but the trophy is not the be-all and end-all. Whereas I think that one of the, if you could pick a fault in this Tottenham side, it's that when they really need to raise their game in a big, high-stakes occasion, they don't, essentially. And whether it's the two goals they conceded against Juventus, or when they threw away a tie that they really should have won, or FA Cup semi-final against Chelsea last season, when they need to raise their game and bring out that level of performance that you need to win a trophy, that's what they haven't been able to do yet. And that's the same whether it's the FA Cup or the Champions League. So do they need to win a trophy? I mean, it's a stupid question in itself, but it's more what the trophy represents, if that makes any sense. It's what they'd have to do to win that trophy rather than the trophy itself that they need.
Rory, what do you think about whether Tottenham have improved enough that they don't need a trophy, or do you think that a trophy is the only way to kind of cap off 4 years of improvement under Pochettino?
Well, I think Daniel Levy would probably say that sustained Champions League qualification before they go back to White Hart Lane would be the more measurable way of saying that they've improved and they've got to where they want to be. I think the trophy thing probably gets slightly overplayed for them. Actually, if you look at their underlying performance metrics, there has been consistent improvement ever since Pochettino took over, and that includes this year. Despite they're probably not going to finish in the same position that they did this year, but they definitely have, in terms of their underlying performance, improved as a team, despite the not much on the surface improvement in the playing staff.
Can you speak about how they have improved this season, even with, as you say, without having added many better players to the squad?
Yeah, well, last season, I think it was quite an interesting thing for them to have to adapt to moving away from White Hart Lane, as in they were playing. Their home record last season obviously was fantastic. Their underlying performances at home were excellent. And this season they've kind of had to adapt slightly. They've had to become more of a counter-attacking team because of the fact that small pitch at White Hart Lane, where they were just overrunning teams with their combined intensity and combinations in the final third, they haven't been able to exploit that in the same way at Wembley, but they've actually had to adjust the way they played. That started with them playing the wing-backs a lot more early in the season, and even now when they've gone back to the back four, it's still a kind of similar style with Dyer dropping in as a third centre-back. But their actual underlying chance creation has changed in the way it's being produced, but it's actually also improved. The underlying numbers have improved.
I think it's hard to kind of disagree with what Pochettino is saying, I think. I mean, you know, a Champions League campaign that involved beating Real Madrid and Borussia Dortmund is obviously more indicative of a team doing well than beating Rochdale and Wimbledon in an FA Cup. But I just don't know whether we should be taking him at face value in what he's saying, really, because obviously he's been so committed to this line of we're on a process and a trophy is a bauble, essentially, and we should be competing for league titles, you know, blah, blah, blah. If he was suddenly to come out now and say, oh, actually, you know, winning the FA Cup would be great and a great indicator of how far we've come. He knows that the narrative would kind of be co-opted into, oh, well, Tottenham need to win the FA Cup to kind of salvage an underwhelming season, which is just completely the opposite of what he's been saying all along. So he, I think maybe, you know, the way he's been talking over the last 2 years is preventing him from actually acknowledging publicly, at least, how important it would be to win a trophy.
I think we're in this strange position with Spurs now where whenever they fail, or even lose, it's being seen as some kind of mental failure. In a way, I think some teams get themselves into this position whereby anything they do wrong is explained as bottling or choking. It's a bit like the South African cricket team. And Tottenham, for whatever reason, are now in that position. But I do think that, you know, for example, Juventus, that I don't think that was necessarily bottling. That was just 5 minutes in which Juve happened to play much better than Spurs. However, going into this FA Cup semi-final against Manchester United, which is now this huge, huge game in Pochettino's time there, probably the biggest single match, I think Spurs are now so much better than United that if they were to lose that game, you could fairly say that it was a bottling.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know what the dictionary definition of bottling is. I mean, I don't think they bottled it against Juventus. I just thought they managed the game very poorly. And that's a footballing deficiency rather than a mental one. I think fans measure the success of a team not just in trophies, but in moments. And like Luke said, beating Real Madrid and Borussia Dortmund, those are great moments. And they're probably bigger than some, you know, beating, I don't know, a Southampton in the League Cup final would necessarily have been. And if you look at some of the great teams in history, Holland 74, Brazil 1982, Keegan's Newcastle, they won nothing, but they are very fondly remembered.
Of course, yeah. Like, I mean, Keegan's Newcastle are far better remembered than the Blackburn Rovers team that won the Premier League in the mid-90s.
I think on the subject of bottling, I think, like, there's actually a... there are a number of statistical things you can look at what bottling means, and you can start to analyse the differences in teams and players' performances in key moments of games and in moments that aren't as significant. So Arsenal would actually be a lot more of a bottling team in the fact that in key moments of games, they tend to go missing. But if you take Spurs and look at their performance at key moments this season, I'd say the Juventus game, whilst it may have been bad game management, they're probably up against the best game-managing team in the world. Their performances in both games against Real Madrid and against Dortmund, both games against United. The only exception would be the away performance at City, but I think a lot of teams could have said that this year, that hasn't gone very well for them. And actually, their performance in key moments of games and the key significant moments have been very good. So I think the bottling thing is definitely a bit unfair.
So I was at Chelsea yesterday to go and see them beat Leicester City in their quarterfinal, which is a very impressive performance in that if they'd lost the game, it would have been the end of Chelsea's season. But the fact that they managed to grind it out, win in extra time and get through to the semi-finals, where they're lucky enough to play Southampton, means that their season will continue probably all the way through to the final at the end, which gives those players something to play for. Given how toxic things have become there politically between Antonio Conte and the board, the fact that the players have managed to dig deep 3 days after losing in Barcelona and prolong their season, I think it speaks very well of their commitment, which is something which has been brought into question recently.
We're all agreed, I think, that Conte's going to go at the end of the season. What's keeping that team together?
I think there's a bit of a sense of wounded pride about those players. Like, I think they are stung by how criticised they were in what Conte hilariously has dubbed the Mourinho season. That is 2015-16. And therefore, they want to prove that they, you know, that they are still top players. I think some of them, their futures are in doubt. I mean, Eden Hazard and Thibaut Courtois, most notably, have got big interest from Real Madrid. So I think there is a sense that they want to prove that they are still worthy of their place at Chelsea, that they should stay. I mean, for those that want to stay, that they want to stay for the new manager, whoever that is.
Yeah, well, I mean, what we see so often in teams that where there's clearly a power vacuum at the, you know, coming up, is that you see a lot of jockeying position, you see a lot of, you know, manoeuvres being made, and obviously the eye gets taken off the ball in terms of the football. But they certainly performed pretty well, I thought, over two legs against Barcelona. And yeah, their season pretty much does come down to these two FA Cup games, you know, possibly, you know, an FA Cup semi-final and an FA Cup final. And if they win something at the end of that season, even if they finish outside the top four, it's something, isn't it?
Intriguingly, Conte has never won a knockout competition as a manager, having lost, obviously, the FA Cup final to Arsenal last year, which I think tells us something about how Conte's management is very much about getting his players to the maximum high level, which they can perform week in, week out in the league, which is how he's won three Serie A titles and one Premier League, rather than a kind, what you might call a kind of, inverted commas, cup manager, who's more about raising his players for specific one-off instances rather than getting that kind of consistent high level.
Carlo Ancelotti.
An interesting thing about that is that that's the one thing missing from Chelsea this year. Last year, their consistency was at both ends of the pitch, in their defensive numbers and their attacking numbers, just unbelievable how they were churning out such consistently high outputs. And actually, I don't think their peak output this season has been any different, really, to what their peak output was last season. It's been games such as the Bournemouth at home game would ring a bell, where they have just completely disappeared in games when they would have never done last year. And actually, I think in the big games, they've been okay. And it's really, if you take the two Barcelona games, where they've lost is just, it's just a, what you'd call variance at the two key ends of the pitch. Courtois was awful in the away leg. Their actually numbers from the game weren't bad, and they've probably do in those games where they need to win games 1-0 in very high significant situations. They miss Costa. I think there's no doubt about that. And Morata doesn't, as good as he is, doesn't quite provide the same threat.
Do you think that having not been in Europe last year, now having to play twice a week has made it harder for them to produce that same consistent high-level performance?
I don't know this, but I get the impression that Conte is a very, very detailed tactical coach. And I get the fact that they were just having to play every week, and the fact that he had time during the week to work on that with the same 11 players that he was playing every week probably had quite a big factor. I mean, they've had to rotate a lot more than they did last year.
One thing I would say about that is notable about this Chelsea squad is actually how short of real quality it is in so many areas. We all talk about the great Chelsea sides of 10 years ago, but they are kind of a memory now, and a lot of quality hasn't been replaced. It's kind of funny how, for a team that has spent so much money over, you know, a 15-year period, how short they are in so many areas. There's a big hole in midfield, for example. They haven't really found, you know, the top class centre backs. They've tried to buy, you know, wing backs, and they've got a lot of sort of eight out of ten players, and their trophy charge has been kind of held together by two or three really, you know, Hazard and Willian and some a lot of quite good players around them. And that's quite surprising, I find.
Yeah, I mean, a good friend of mine who's a Chelsea season ticket holder said to me the other day that he thinks that Bakayoko's the worst player of the Abramovich era. Maybe not in absolute terms, because, you know, there is Papi Gilabogi, but then
it's a whole other podcast, that.
Given that they spent 40 million on him, his underperformance is remarkable. He was hauled off yesterday at half-time because he got booked, and Conte was worried that he was going to get a second yellow.
Recruitment has definitely been an issue over the last few years. They haven't bought enough really sort of quality world-class players. It almost seems that they've tried to be a little bit too smart with their recruitment, especially when you consider how well they've played the loan market, that they're almost buying players with a view to selling them on, or with a view to what their, you know, residual value is, or getting value out of the market, as opposed to, you know, who's going to do the job for them, you know, right now.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably argue that outside of Hazard, the two top world class players they've had come through there in the last 5 years, they've sold.
Yeah,
De Bruyne and Salah.
Yeah, which is perfect, because that leads us on to Salah, which is our next topic. He scored another 4 goals on Saturday, which I think takes him to 35 goals for this remarkable debut season, not a debut season in English football at all, because he was here with Chelsea. I didn't watch the game. Who did, and what did you think about it?
I listened to the game. I listened to it on TalkSport on the way back from Swansea. And what I will say, my expert analysis of that game was that Salah scored a lot of goals. He scored a hell of a lot of goals. Every time I tuned in, he was scoring a new goal in a different way against exactly the same defenders who you'd think would have learned how to deal with him, but haven't.
Rory, I remember you telling me at the start of the season you thought Salah would do well. Has he overperformed your expectations?
I think it's hard to say he hasn't overperformed, even if it is slight. I think I would have definitely said at the start of the year that his underlying output of chances he was creating for other players and chances he was creating for himself at Roma would have suggested quite easily that he was going to be able to translate well to the Premier League. The other thing I would have definitely said is that a lot of the things that are quite key in using analytics and recruitment for is looking at the suitability and moving a player to a certain team. And there's no doubt that he has been signed for a team that suits the way that plays a way that suits getting his maximum performance out of him. High speed attack, a lot of counter-attacking, particularly output down his side. And if you compare that, you know, just as a one-off example, to someone like Batshuayi, who I guess an underlying statistical profile would also say could end up being, not maybe on the same level as Salah, but could end up being a top-level Premier League player, he didn't make the right move for him, whereas Salah has definitely moved to the club that suited maximising his output the best. But again, 35 goals is definitely a slight overperformance, but I wouldn't call it an outlier. I think he'll probably, the likelihood is, regress slightly, but not by very much.
Do you think that Liverpool signing Salah would have been a signing inspired by his data, like a kind of a data-driven recruitment approach?
It's hard to say what, you know, exactly what drives recruitment at individual clubs, but I think if you look at the players that Liverpool have signed in the last 3 years, I think a lot of them would have also been flagged up by underlying data. So I think common sense would just say that there obviously is some kind of analysis there, similar to using analytics, that is playing a part in the recruitment process.
Do you mean Sadio Mane and Roberto Firmino?
Mane, Firmino, Naby Keita, even Van Dijk I would put in there as well. Coutinho, I don't know how long ago that was. But the key high-profile signings of, you know, from an analytics perspective, I would have never said they are a really bad signing. I think you'd always be on the side that they were a good signing.
I mean, Salah has, like you were saying, has his chance creation for Roma last season was very good, but he's never really shown this pure goal scoring touch. I mean, is his finishing this year, is that how much of an outlier is that, and how unpredictable was it?
That will be really interesting to see, actually, because I don't think we can judge that over one season whether it is an outlier. So if you take someone like Kane, in his first season when he was scoring loads of goals in the Premier League, people said this is an outlier, but he's done it now so consistently that you have to accept that the quality of his finishing is just above a level that underlying data is going to be able to predict. I doubt Salah will be on that level. That's why I said he will probably regress to the mean slightly, but there's no doubt that his finishing has been exceptional, and time will tell whether or not he can repeat that. I would go back to say that the way Liverpool play suits getting him into such strong finishing positions. That's, you know, quite a key asset that means there should be some repeatability to what he's done in terms of goal scoring.
Is it harder to judge a player like Salah? Because obviously last season he was playing in a slightly different position to what he is now. And I was at the Watford game at the start of the season, where in the first half he was completely crowded out because he was playing deeper and he was playing a lot wider than what he's playing now. So obviously when you've got a player like Kane, presumably it's quite easy to tell using the data how he's doing, because he's always going to be getting into similar positions. Mm-hmm. But whereas Salah has, his position has sort of evolved over the course of a season, do you think like Liverpool will have been even more surprised that he's kind of getting those results?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Whether or not, I definitely don't think there'll be any luck behind it, but they have managed to put him in the position now that is getting the best out of him. And I think that is definitely something you could profile. You could profile at Roma how, where most of his chances were coming from, where his key attacking outputs were coming from, where the areas they were coming from, the kind of the passes he may have been receiving from players before, the types of attacks. So I don't know, but I definitely think that it looks like Liverpool have done a lot of that and realised that they probably do have a very, very, very high value asset. And actually, that's the asset that should be channeling a lot of their attacking output through. Because if you look at, I mean, there's no doubt that there has been a slight decline in Mane's performance since Salah's been there. But I think a lot of that, if you watch them, is just that Mane is just forced to play quite a bit deeper. Salah is now the man on the shoulder all the time that Mane was before. So I think there's obviously been a strategic thinking process at Liverpool to be like, right, Salah is our attacking asset. We're going to make sure we play a way that maximises his performance. And, you know, it looks like it's been the right decision.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Given all the success that Liverpool have had signing attacking players who have been flagged up by data, do you think that they've struggled to find defensive players on a similar grounds? Or is it harder to is it harder to buy defenders using data than it is attacking players?
I think, I mean, there's no doubt that Van Dijk is a strong data and visual identified, you know, one of the best defenders in the Premier League. On the subject of whether or not it's easier to identify attacking players and defensive players using data, it's definitely easier to identify attacking players. That doesn't mean it's any more profitable or any more, you know, right to use data to evaluate defensive players. I think that there's a lot of stuff you can do on evaluating defenders on how the areas around their average position on the pitch is penetrated by the teams they play against, and not just using raw things like tackles and interceptions. And that goes a lot, that takes you a lot further in evaluating the predictive utility of their performance moving forward, because it gives it a lot more context to how good they are as opposed to the team they were playing in. On Liverpool, I think there's no doubt their attacking recruitment has been better than their defensive recruitment. But actually, I think most models are they're picking out why Liverpool are bad defensively, and it's actually a structural thing as opposed to the individual players. Obviously, the individual players contribute, but they continue to concede too many shots in dangerous areas, which I think comes through, you know, a lot of the way they're organised, and that part of that's out of the way they attack as well.
It's interesting because this is a question that Jurgen Klopp gets asked all the time, and he's whenever he's asked, like, why do you guys concede so many goals, he prefers to blame it on individual mistakes. And he, I remember him one after the game where they drew 3-3 at Arsenal around Christmas, where they were brilliant for like 80 minutes, then had this terrible 5 minutes where they conceded 3 stupid goals out of nowhere. He was asked in the press briefing, like, why are you such an attacking coach? Do you ever want to curb your instincts? And he was insisting, no, I'm a really defensive coach. Like, I'm a defensive coach. I care a lot about defending. But I think that's probably a way of getting himself off the hook and blaming his players. That's probably my impression of it.
It was very similar after the Leicester game, which they won 3-2, but should have won it by a lot more. They just conceded 2 stupid goals. And I think the exact thing he said was, if a guy doesn't push out, if a defender doesn't push up, I can't drive it. I can't take him in a car and drive him 15 yards out of the penalty area. Again, blaming it on an individual error. And I think the way that Klopp sees defending is very different to the way English football has traditionally seen it, as kind of almost a separation of powers between you've got your defence and you've got your attack. Whereas for Klopp, I honestly think he genuinely doesn't see the distinction between attack and defence. he sees the distinction as between you've got the ball as a team or you don't have the ball as a team. And so it's not merely about attack being the best form of defence. If you're attacking well, that is your defence as well. And that goes back to his Dortmund side, which actually, when as well as Hummels and Subotic played for him, they didn't have a huge amount to do in those title winning seasons because their front pressing was just so good that they were giving their defenders less to do, and that's the problem that the Liverpool have.
I know, as a part of that, I know that Klopp also doesn't think that goalkeepers are a big deal. I know that last summer the Liverpool board said to him, how about we buy a new goalkeeper for this season, Jürgen? And his approach was, well, if we're going to spend that money, I'd rather spend the money on an outfield player because I think we can get by with the keepers we've had. Obviously, in the course of this season, they've had to drop Mignolet and go to Karius. I'm not sure whether Karius is the long-term solution or whether they will have to go and buy someone in the summer. But clearly, this is an issue where he is slightly at odds with how we traditionally think about things in the UK.
I think he can be, if it's the best way to describe Jürgen Klopp, you can definitely describe him as like a high-variance manager, a high-variance coach. If he ran a distribution curve of expected scores in the Liverpool games, you'd get a lot around the extremes, which if you compared to Conte or Mourinho. And that's why you are going to see them lose 5-0 at City, but then also outclass them and win 4-3 at home. And that's why they could, they're in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, and they could. There's nothing stopping you saying that there's a chance that they go to the Bernabeu and really expose a Real Madrid team if they drew them in the semi-finals, but also that they could get beaten 4 or 5-0. And I think that you can see that in the way they play. That's reflected.
Given that they're such a high variance team, are they generally performing in line with what you thought at the start of the season, Liverpool?
Yeah, we had them as we thought they'd be the second best team. I think they're very high variance, and also they're also kind of very susceptible to the way the other team plays. So if the other team suits Liverpool being able to counterattack at speed and expose them with pace, etc., then that suits them. But then they've had certain games where teams have perform the way which really frustrates Liverpool. I think since Coutinho's gone, if you take the Swansea game where they lost 1-0 there, where teams did just be really deep, low block, and frustrate Mane and Salah being able to get any space off the shoulder. So I think they're very susceptible to the way the other team plays more than other teams.
I was really actually very encouraged by the way they pursued Van Dijk. That having failed to get him in the summer, they could very easily have gone, right, Jürgen, do you want to spend this 75 million on another player? He's like, no, we want this guy. We've identified him and we want this guy. And not only does he pass the eye test, but he also he provides them with a real kind of measurable threat at set pieces as well, which is he'll chip in with 3 or 4 goals a season. It's the same with Keita, that they seem to have identified a player for a role and they're really quite dogmatic about wanting that player and nobody else.
Yeah. Away from Liverpool, further down the table, Rory, are there any other teams who, through your own research, you think are overperforming or who you think are maybe perhaps undervalued by other forms of data analysis?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting the kind of layers of statistical analysis you've got in football. So you've got where people probably think what still goes on inside clubs is we're just going to use results and goals as a way of measuring performance. Beyond that, you've got statistics such as shots, passes, dribbles, tackles that probably are used in the wrong context a lot of the time. And if you took the kind of the next form of that, it's turning that into a model. And I think expected goals would be the model that most people now might be aware of and are.
Because that's the one that we see on Match of the Day at the end of every game when they'll flash up, Swansea 1.2.
So essentially you say we're going to assign, rather than a shot to the scoreboard, it's worth 0 or 1. It either ends up in a goal or it doesn't. To an expected goals model, a shot will be worth somewhere between 0 and 1 based on the percentage chance of it going in. And that depends on where it was, what the action before was, what part of the body the shot came from, who took it, loads of different things. A traditional expected goals model that was only shot-based and evaluating the quality of shots and the quantity of shots the teams are creating and conceding without taking into consideration anything to do with the position of other players on the pitch would probably have Burnley somewhere near the bottom three. But the truth is that has just been continually misrepresented. And that, a kind of simplified shot-based model, does actually miss a lot of key tactical dimensions. The teams, Burnley, one key thing would be that it's just how well they block the ball really is a huge outlier to the rest of the team. Like a shot against them from 14 yards just is worth less than a shot from 14 yards against another team, just because of
they're getting bodies in the way.
They're getting bodies in the way, and it's also there's I don't know if it's something to watch, but there is a technique thing to Tarkowski and me, how well they do it, and that's a key thing. And then there's also there's a certain defensive functionality to them as a team that you can start to model that really frustrates other teams being able to get into their natural way of playing. And I think that's also undervalued by models that are just using Burnley's previous performances, because there is a, they do just have a stifling factor on the way other teams play.
What practical things are they doing to stifle other to stop other teams getting into their rhythm?
They very good coaching. Yeah. I think they press in quite an unconventional way. I think they actually attack in quite an unconventional way. That they actually have a very, very good mix. I think they've probably got a reputation being quite direct, but they're a lot more variant in the way they attack than people give them credit for, between playing out, playing through midfield and being direct. And they've got a lot of very awkward players to play against. I don't think many models would say that Ashley Barnes is, you know, a kind of high-level Premier League centre-forward, but I'm pretty sure if you did a survey of most Premier League centre-backs, they'd have him quite high up there as the most awkward player to defend against slash be able to predict what he's going to do in games.
I mean, you say models in plural, and I think this is maybe one of the biggest kind of uncertainties about XG, that there's not one XG model. Everybody has their own. Is that right?
Yeah, but I say, when I said the traditional, or what I call a basic XG model, has would have Burnley as still significantly overachieving, I think that model, there is a number of kind of consistent like factors in it that a lot of XG models would have, right? So where the shot comes from on the pitch is assigned a certain value. Right. Whether or not it was a cross or a through ball before it is assigned a certain value. Okay. Whether or not it came from a defensive error is assigned a certain value, etc., etc.
So, I mean, just to take an example, just to kind of break this down, say you get a shot from 14 yards with your left foot from a cross, and there's no defender in between. The, mm-hmm. You know, you can model that, right?
Yeah.
Does it take into account whether the player is left-footed, right-footed, or two-footed?
So this is what I'm. So I would say that a very basic model wouldn't, right? And that's why that can still miss a lot. And I think we need to move beyond XG as a kind of basic concept to be able to start to model more and more complex factors that a lot of just basic event data and shot models can't pick up.
Right, because I mean, I think the reason that a lot of people don't understand it is because every shot is by definition unique, and while you can, you know, you can cluster them, it's actually really difficult. It's really difficult to model a shot, basically, that, you know, given how many millions and billions of unique situations, yeah, you know, that can be thrown up in just to, you know, that one act.
I think, but I don't know, I've always taken the view that being difficult is good, as in, you know, being difficult means that if you can get that right, the competitive advantage you're going to be able to gain is going to be significant. And I think that's where football is quite unique, relevant to other sports. If you take golf, for example, then a lot of what analytical principles will pick up, will 98% of that will probably be picked up by the human eye as well, because it's very confined set space, etc. I mean, that I've just thrown those numbers out. No, nowhere.
Yeah. Because one guy in one club.
Exactly. So when people say that analytics isn't suited to football, I think what they mean is, I think they just mean it's really hard, right? It's not suited. But I would say that the harder it is, the more suited it is, because the more opportunity there is to gain competitive advantage if you get it right. So accepting, and where people that are trying to advocate the use of analytics in football have to get themselves to, is that don't just keep it as a simple, generalised expected goals model. Accept that there's huge levels of complexity and huge factors and every shot's unique. And then try to be realistic about the limitations of that, but also the potential strengths of being able to model all of those complex factors.
How far away are we from that stage? Because it just seems like there's still so much white noise.
Yeah. Very, long, long way away. Long, long way away. And I'd say there's different, if you take the, you know, different sectors in sport or in football are kind of attempting analytical modelling, right? And I'd say you've got people have been very successful in betting and they'd be right at the top, but that makes a lot of sense, because it's always been quite easy for them to correlate the strength of their model versus what the outcome is, which is essentially just profit, right? Whereas then if you take clubs, they'd be a lot further behind, but I think where clubs have been quite resistant is that it's very hard, you know, when we've accepted that, you know, there's huge variance, it's difficult to model, football's a low scoring game, there's also not many games in the season, it was going to take a lot of time to be able to see the rewards of a successful model. So it's just natural that that would be behind other sectors. So I think we're definitely further behind there. But also, I think even the modelling that's going on, I think we have to accept that it can always be improved because of the number of complex factors there are. And being able to integrate all of those things, I think anyone who tries to tell you it's easy is just wrong.
Do you think that the recent successes of, say, Brentford or Brighton, who are obviously both owned by men who've been very successful in betting and like to apply those models to how they run their clubs, do you think that points to like a growing receptiveness in English club football to this kind of thing?
The truth is it probably hasn't transcended into the receptiveness you'd expect. I think that what probably hasn't helped in the receptiveness is that, firstly, I think if you take those two clubs, if you take what's the common theme there in the structures, is that that structure is being put in place by the owner. So I think it's very difficult, if it doesn't happen at ownership level, that it ends up actually kind of overarching the whole strategy of the club. And actually the kind of political dynamics of so many football clubs are so complicated, and there's a lot of big job insecurity. There's a lot of, you know, resistance to innovation, because if it goes wrong, we're out of the job. And that's why it's so important that it does come from the owner. Because if you take the owners of those two clubs, and I don't know, but I'm fairly sure if they were having a poor run of form, but their underlying performance metrics were saying this performance is okay, the manager's not getting sacked, which probably wouldn't happen at other clubs if the owner wasn't in charge of that process. But I think that also what probably needs to happen is there needs to be a greater marrying of the two communities. You've got a traditional football community, and you've got a kind of analytics community that is trying to get expected goals into the mainstream, and it's probably not doing a very good job of accepting that the complexities that you've talked about for as a starting point. So therefore there are limitations. It's just saying no, XG will solve everything, rather than saying no, this is what it can do and this is how it can, you know, get us closer to where we need to get to. And the football world probably needs to try and integrate it in a certainly different way to what they're doing at the moment, which isn't in a strategic way. It's almost as a kind of like error check, right? What do the numbers say? Is this player good or is he not? And it's quite binary.
This I think is the main sticking point, and it's almost as if two tribes have emerged, which are becoming ever more entrenched. I think, in theory, potentially there's so much great, you know, insight to be gained from almost applying an academic rigor to football. You know, people are writing master's dissertations and on football. People are doing PhDs in it. That kind of stuff can only really benefit, you know, the English game, which has really been, you know, quite boastful of its anti-intellectual streak over the years. But where I suppose a lot of the, you know, the analytics crowd, I guess, we, you know, I think where a lot of them go wrong is where their own intellectual, you know, work becomes a form of dogma in itself, as if, you know, I really think a lot of people you know, in stats could benefit from just being a little bit more open about the limitations, and not saying we have the golden key to understanding football and you are all stupid.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And that has actually been I think that side of the stats community has been as much of a hindrance as the football community to the actual penetration.
Playing devil's advocate though, do you think that when that marrying of those kind of two communities does take place, and when it does become more mainstream, do you think that is a good thing for English football and for football generally? Or do you think it kind of reinforces the power structures we've already got? Because the statistical stories we've been kind of fed so far are always through this kind of almost like egalitarian kind of prism, where it's like, you've got teams like Brentford and Midtjylland in Denmark and Brighton to an extent. And it's this attitude of, oh, well, these teams aren't traditional powerhouses and they need a new way to catch up with the big boys because they can't afford to spend 8 million on Paul Pogba. Mm-hmm. So they chase these kind of alternative methods. But surely when one of those clubs achieves, you know, a certain level of success and these models become more mainstream, are you not just going to get the kind of best and most expensive models adopted by the clubs with the most cash?
These clubs will be left behind.
They
already are. I mean, the big clubs are doing most of their data work, you know. It's certainly not open. Certainly not out in the open. Wasn't it Arsenal bought
StatDNA.
StatDNA. There's a real kind of secret arms race going on. So yeah, I think.
But it doesn't stop, you know, Conte getting sacked at the end of the season, does it? Or it doesn't stop. It seems to be on quite a almost shallow level.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a big difference, particularly at the big clubs, about the work that is going on in data and how much it is being implemented into decision making. So it's like you say about the recruitment at Liverpool. The truth is, we don't know how much the data had a say and how much Jurgen Klopp had a say and how much the owners had a say. And that's actually, I think, where the real challenge moving forward. See, I don't see, if you take, I don't really see it as a data issue. It's more just a way to find competitive advantage. At the moment, there is such inefficiency in the way data is being used by clubs that it's a significant competitive advantage. Who knows, in 25 years, we might be at a point that everyone is, you know, reaching a level of perfection with the way they're using it and identifying talent. And there's a next competitive advantage. So I think that's, I guess that would be an answer to the question about whether that does happen. Yes, it probably does get to a point where if everyone is at the same level and doing the same things, it just reinforces the strength of the teams with the big money. And then it becomes a job of the smaller clubs to find the next competitive advantage, I think.
Do you think that it's harder to find a competitive advantage in international football, or it's harder to accurately predict and model international football than domestic football, given there's far less data on it?
I think it's definitely harder to accurately predict and model, therefore the potential for the advantage found is bigger because it's harder to model. You've obviously got severe limitations in data of the players that are playing international level playing together. A lot of the games aren't relevant to the games that they're playing in the World Cup, so you do have to move away from a kind of team-based model and start to move towards a more very granular player-based model that tries to model player performance, tries to model the suitability of players to other players based off a limitation of data that they've got playing together. And that's very, very difficult. But as I said, I think the competitive advantage, if you can get that right in international football, is probably bigger. Because if you take a Premier League club, and if you've got, you're just trying to say, we're going to try and simulate a game or a season, and what's the percentage chance of Man City finishing here, Everton finishing here? The truth is, a basic level of analysis can probably get you to a relatively competent stage because they play the same teams every week. They've got results against different teams. You've watched performances against different teams. So just to kind of like intuitively doing it, you know, makes you quite, you can probably get to a higher basic level than you can in the Champions League or definitely in the World Cup, because you're base data set of what you've got to use to be able to try and price that or percentage chance that up is severely limited. So I think that whilst it makes it harder, if you get closer to reaching the top level of being able to do it, the competitive advantage you gain is bigger.
I was talking to the Iceland manager before Euro 2016, Jaime, joint manager at the time, Jaime Hallgrímsson, and he was saying that the amount of time you get in international football to prepare can actually offer you a real, really big competitive advantage. He's saying by the time the players arrive, 95-98% of your job is already done. And for those countries or for those coaching teams that use that time in an efficient way, that there is potentially a huge advantage to be gained there. And which is why I think, you know, the World Cup will be won by the team which has done the best kind of preparation before the tournament, rather than you know what they do during those 4 weeks.
I agree with that, and I think that, and that's a really good point about time, is the fact that they are, it's almost, they're in a, you know, one of the kind of kickbacks given to being able to use innovation around data, etc., in football, is that that's a very kind of long-term approach to take, and that clubs, not that I agree with this, but clubs don't have the time to be able to integrate that on a week-to-week basis. But that's definitely not an excuse that can be used for not embracing it at international level.
Who do you think is going to win the World Cup?
Well, I don't think in binary terms, but I think we make Brazil favourites. Yeah, but there's a very, very big caveat on that, which is certain players not fit at the moment.
Do you think, if how much of a difference would Neymar make if he wasn't fit?
I think somewhere between 10-15% at least. Yeah,
and would he then have what, Spain and Germany and France?
And Argentina, the best five, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd go for France without a huge amount of confidence, but look at the squad.
Surely Brazil. I reckon Brazil.
And what about the final stages of the Champions League?
What do we think?
Yeah.
I think that the final stages of the Champions League are fascinating, particularly this year with the teams involved, because it really does come down to, there's a lot of, you know, going back to this thing about being difficult to simulate because the teams don't play each other, and there's a really like fascinating clash of styles. Madrid Juventus will be really interesting, but I think if I was looking at the way the markets are pricing it up now, I think that Liverpool's X factor still is quite a big thing. They will be very, very high variance, but they do have the ability to beat, you know, all the big teams, as do Juventus. They don't have a similar style. One of the reasons I think Liverpool were consistently undervalued in the Champions League is because, like I said, a lot of teams frustrated them by that low block and the way they played against, you know, teams like Swansea. None of these teams, apart from maybe Juventus, are going to do that to them. Everyone is going to come onto them, and everyone is therefore going to give them the opportunity to counterattack. So if they don't, if their defence does hold up and they are able to counter and play the way they have in some of the big games this year, then I think they could be a real threat.
Do you think Manchester City might be too open to win the Champions League? Or do you?
No, I think they're rightly favourites. They're the best team in Europe at the moment. And obviously there's a number of factors that will come in. But I think there's obviously this thing that people are saying they haven't played anyone of the class they're going to have to play to win it. But I almost think that's a kind of, it's just a flaw of how, it's almost how good they've been that the people need to find one thing to say about them, and that's it. You know, they can't do it until it's put in front of them. And actually all the big teams, apart from that one game against Liverpool that have been put in front of them in the Premier League, they've dealt with pretty well.
At the start of the season, would your model have predicted City getting 100 points and 110 goals or whatever they're on for?
No. I think we were quite slow to react to actually how good they were. We definitely had them as the best team, but no, definitely not as good as they were. Like, we wouldn't have had them as the best team in the world, which I think they are.
Excellent. Well, on that note, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back. Thank you, Jonathan.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Rory.
Thank you.
And thank you, Luke.
Thank you very much.
And we'll see you all again next Monday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.